Hello and welcome to Dyslexia Explored. I'm Darius Nomdaron, your host, and today we have a stand-up comedian with us who's also the CEO of our own company, training company. She started as a stand-up comedian straight out of uni, and then she had this crazy idea about bringing stand-up comedy into schools to help children with their reading and writing. And then she also got into this whole how comedy can help with Patch Adams. You remember the Robin Williams film? She ended up actually going to work with Patch Adams as a scholarship for a couple of weeks to learn what he was doing and so on. And she is now head of happiness and the founder of a company called Laughology, a learning development organization that does like school inset days and kids workshops and goes into big organizations and does resilience workshops and mental health workshops and well-being things. She's done a master's in psychology and she's on the Dyslexia Explored podcast because guess what? She's dyslexic and we want to hear her dyslexia story. So let me introduce you to Stephanie Davis. It's great to have you here, Stephanie.
Oh, lovely. That was a big build up. I hope I managed to make everything happen for you.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. It's good to hear that fascinating journey. I'm really looking forward to seeing how dyslexia has helped you in that journey, you know, and, you know, how you're going into workplaces and helping people. And I know you mentioned your dyslexia quite a bit in your workshops, and you've done some articles with the British Dyslexia Association, etc., which put you on our radar. And so let's start right at the beginning. Where did your story begin? What was life like before dyslexia came on your radar?
So I went to school at first in Liverpool. I'm a Scouser originally, and nothing really major there, you know, was getting on with things. And I think all was kind of fine. You don't really have a self-awareness. Then I moved to the Isle of Man and was put into a new school with having to find my way with new teachers and new friends and things like that. And it was probably towards the end of secondary school that I just started to really notice that I, in my head, wasn't as able to pick stuff up as quickly as the other kids. And you just think that you're not blessed. You know, you have this, you wouldn't know any difference. You just think that you're not a clever kid. You think there's some clever kids and some not clever kids. And I remember that being my thought process. And as I got into high school over there, that's probably where things started to go a little bit wrong for me. So got suspended quite a few times. And when I look back now, it's because I didn't feel like I fitted in, and also I'd be embarrassed. I was also the class clown. I've got a lovely quote in my feedback from teachers that says, "Stephanie needs to learn that joking and clowning around is not a career option." Actually, Mr. Hayward, I think you'll find it is. But so all that, and so you then tend to get a name that you're naughty, and so you get sent out. Then I missed lots because I was suspended or sent out. I was also put into the nurture group, what they called the nurture group at school, and just didn't fit in at all. Didn't know why I was in there. I actually was dead keen on helping some of the other kids in there as well, who probably, you know, were more diverse, neurodiverse than me. And then I was also put back a year, but refused to be. So I probably did 2 months of being put back a year and then just started turning up to my normal classes and refused to get out. And that's when I was put on the expulsion list because I barricaded a teacher into a classroom. And I'm not saying that that's right at all, but they said to me, you're too thick to be in this class, Steph. That's why you've been put back a year. And they were probably, I can completely understand it's not teachers' fault. You know, they don't know how to handle kids like me who are back chatty and naughty or I don't like to call it naughty, it's a behaviour because of how I felt. And so I just missed lots and lots of school. I had one amazing teacher, and that's what I'd say to teachers. It just takes you to see someone differently. Mrs. Harmer, and she identified that I was good at art and drama and got me all into all those clubs. And she's always saying, my door's open for you. She was just incredible, actually. And so she got me into drama and onto workshops, writing for Brookside and stuff like that, which as a Scouser, that's your pinnacle. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
made it. I went on a Brookside writing workshop and it was interesting because they said to me, Stephanie, your ideas are great, but when you write them down, you're better directing. And they put me into a director's role, which was really interesting because I didn't know then I'm dyslexic. And so I went to...
For those of you in America, because I know we've got people in America and Australia listening on this, that's kind of like...
It's like neighbours for America.
It's like neighbours. Yeah. Absolutely. Like
the Scouse neighbours, the Liverpool neighbours. Yeah, it was a big...
It's a big deal.
Big deal in Liverpool. And it was so a TV show, and they were putting on these workshops for people.
How old were you?
At the time, so I was 15 then.
Okay. Was that because, you know how sometimes when you're naughty, you get put onto these kind of programs to get you out the way and do
that's
something
exactly
productive?
That's exactly why it was.
Yeah. Okay.
I thought I was chosen. and yeah, I was chosen.
You were chosen.
All the other teachers were going, get her in.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So I was out of school for a couple of weeks, you know, doing this, which I thought was amazing. I'm really flourished in those environments.
Yes.
So I left school with hardly anything. Somehow I got myself into sixth form. I begged them to take me in. I think my dad did as well. And I might as well have just not been there for 2 years. Why they took me on, I just do not know. But anyway, I left school and I went to Performing Arts College, and it was only there that I had a brilliant tutor who identified that I was dyslexic and changed my life, really, helped me and got me lots of things that were super helpful. I realised, gosh, well, if I think about it like this, I can do this, and these are things I can do. So really changed my life. And he also got me into stand-up comedy as well. So
can we give him a shout out?
What's his name? Well, there's two guys. There's Roger, I can't remember his last name now, Roger Phillips it is, and Nick Owen from Lipper. And they were just super brilliant.
So I often ask people what the wake-up call was, you know? What was the moment and what were the circumstances that sort of woke you up to the dyslexia? So they helped you, but was there anything in particular that was the wake-up call?
I think I was putting in assignments and probably taking much longer over them. For me... it was more understanding information that comes in. So when I was reading stuff, I was just thinking, I just don't get these words. And so I'd spend a lot of time over the words for certain assignments, because even though I was in Performing Arts College, I still had to write assignments. And it was only when I'd sit with Roger and he'd explain it in another way, and I'd ping and I'd get it. And I'm like, well, why have they written it like this then? And it was in those interactions, those in one-to-ones, when I just needed someone to explain something in a different way. And that's when he said to me, do you know what dyslexia is? And actually, the really sad thing is, dyslexia, definitely when I was younger, it was seen as you're thick. So I said, I had friends at school who were dyslexic, and they were all put in the lower bottom sets as well. So I actually didn't understand what it was at the time. I just thought it means you're thick, if I'm honest. And that's a really horrible thing to think. But when you start learning all about it, I think that's when the pin dropped and my life started to change. because you realize it's actually, well, I call it my superpower now. And the more I've grown with it, the more I've realized, but definitely those interactions with Roger, for sure, where he would sit down and just go through information with me. It was a light bulb moment going on.
Fantastic. And what was your main challenge, did you find, with dyslexia once you had sort of woken up to it? What did you find was your main challenge?
So for me, it's understanding information on when it's first presented to me. It's that being able to take that in and understand the context of it. I can read the words, but they don't really make sense. And so with that, I need to understand what it means to me in my world. And what, interestingly, recently, I went to see Susie Dent. So for those of you who don't know who Susie Dent is, she's on a show over here called Countdown, and she's a word specialist, isn't she?
Okay.
She's a word specialist.
Yeah, let's do the dyslexia thing, which is just to describe it with some basic words. Yes.
Yeah, she's a word specialist.
Word specialist, yeah.
And she's written and a lot of dictionaries and stuff like that. So I went to see her speak because she was talking about words and the backgrounds and the stories behind words.
Oh, yes.
And that, for a dyslexic, brings a word to life, because there's words like bright, which has got a H in and a G in. Has it got a H and a G in? I don't know. Yeah, it has.
Yes, it does.
And as a dyslexic, you're like, oh, that doesn't make sense at all. And she tells the story behind that. And so context is everything. And this is what I learned quite early on. So I might read something, but I haven't got a clue what it means. But you give me the context, the story, the understanding behind it, that's how my brain works.
Yeah.
And when I went to see Susie Dent, and she explained all the stories behind some of these words, and it helped me remember some of, okay, I get why that word's spelled in such a stupid way.
Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic. So tell us a little bit about, you know, dyslexia is your superpower. You know, what have you got from dyslexia? You know, what's the rewards you've got from it?
Oh, wow. Well, I wouldn't be here today running Laughology if I wasn't dyslexic. So if we go back a little bit.
Actually, just before you say, you know, Laughology as a word, that's a very dyslexic thing to do, isn't it? To sort of mash up two words, to ship them, basically, you know, and you've got laughter for the stand-up comedy and the psychology, and you put them together and you've got Laughology. Fantastic. Love it.
And that's my superpower. See? Yeah. So, to build on that. So when we deliver training to schools or organizations, there's so much in psychology that's useful, but it uses really big words and big language.
Yes.
And then it switches people and you go, I don't get that.
Yes.
And to give you an example, so there's something in psychology called common cognitive errors. Now, what stupid grey phrase. However, the technique is really useful. So it's just about when your thinking is unhelpful. So we call it wonky thinking at Laughology, or wonky language. So when your thinking's just a bit wonky. And so that is, in part, is my superpower. And if I go back, it's changed my life. It's made me who I am. I would never be without it at all. And I feel really sorry for people who look at it as a disability. I can understand why, because people look at it, but I mean outside, you know, who look at me and feel sorry for me. I feel sorry for them because they haven't got this superpower. Because stand-up comedy, and if you probably research, a lot of stand-up comics have got dyslexia.
I suspect so, yeah. You know, my daughter keeps saying, Dad, I reckon James Acaster's dyslexic. You've got to get James Acaster on the podcast. She's a total James Acaster fan.
He's like, brilliant,
and,
isn't he?
You know, but you can look at him and you go, you are so dyslexic.
Yeah, because he's all over the place. He's just all over the place.
But he's got, and the you know, Eddie Izzard, dyslexic,
yeah.
You know. But the thing about dyslexia is, did you know that people with dyslexia have got wider angled vision?
No, that's,
you know, even their eyes are slightly wider angled lenses, you know, eyes. You know, it's just a small physical expression of our brains are constantly wanting the wide angle view.
Oh.
And so it's like your analogy example of, you know, you've got a bit of, you know, a book or whatever, and it's like a telephoto lens onto a subject, and it's in detail and so on. And your brain is hungering for, let's just zoom out a bit, see the context, and then I can relate to what you're saying, because we're wide angled lenses, you know. And I see this in children, in my tutoring them, etc. And, you know, a teacher will come to the class and say, we're going to talk about this tree, you know, because this is going to be our subject in geography or whatever. And the child will be, if you take a literal example, looking at this landscape and seeing 50 different trees, whereas the teacher is pointing to one particular tree in a field that's an oak tree and so on, and is talking about it, and you're scanning around going, he's not told me exactly where it is. And 10 minutes in, you go, oh, he's talking about that tree. I've got you, because you've put together the clues. And so I constantly say to teachers, look, start from the big picture. You know, do you remember how we were doing this? Do you remember how we're doing that? And what's happening is this wide-angled dyslexic thinker is going from wide to medium to telephoto and zooming into what you're wanting. And comedians are just masters at this wide-angled thinking.
Yeah, it's exactly. And do you know what? You saying that just makes sense so much with everything. That the reason why I've got a team of 16 people, and I always say to them, okay, what's the big picture here? Tell me, what's the high level? And I drive them mad because I think high level and they want the detail. But yeah, comedy just, you know, changed my life. But dyslexia was the foundation for that, because one of my, I suppose, things that I did in school was I compensated for feeling thick by coming across very, very confident, being the class clown. I could always make people laugh. I could always be the entertainer. And so I compensated for that. But also because I would get words wrong, and I still do. My husband is hysterical at some of the words that I get wrong. And I'll tell you an example of one in a minute, which was really funny. I would then be able to laugh at myself. But actually getting words wrong, then it's my superpower. So because I see words and I combine them now, yeah, like laughology and wonky thinking. So actually that's what helped me do comedy, because I see the world in this very topsy-turvy way. And I observe things that perhaps other people don't. And so comedy opened up the world to me, because as a comedian, you need to go to a new, whether it's the north or south, and you need to read the local paper, because you need to have an understanding of what's going on locally for context for the gig. So I had a reason to want to read stuff, to want to write, to, whereas before in school I got really turned off by it. And so that's what really motivated me to want to find techniques to learn and then take that into schools, so no kid would ever go through the experience that I went through. And what was lovely about delivering stand-up comedy in schools is you would always get given the children like me, you know?
Yeah.
So it was a bit of payback time as well, you know, because I get this group of young people, 15 or 20 young people, and you know, the teachers would go, phew, oh, have that. And I'm going, oh, I know what you're like, because I'm one of you. But, and they come really quite bulgy, you know, they'd have the attitude that I had. And by the end of it, what was so lovely is they do stand-up comedy in front of their peers, in front of their parents, in front of their teachers. And you'd have the teachers coming up to us and saying, wow, I wouldn't do that. that's incredible for that kid to get up. So the teachers saw that child, that young person, in a different light. And I know how that feels,
yeah,
to be seen as a no-hoper, to be cast aside. So for the teacher to be saying to that kid, wow, that's incredible, I wouldn't do that, it gives the kid a boost of confidence.
Yeah.
And then that kid sees themselves in a different light, and it's just one of the best things ever to do.
You know, I've been thinking about this a bit. It's like often you feel like a problem at school, and that's one of the biggest barriers with dyslexia. Even if you're not badly behaved, you know, you may be the quiet kid who's withdrawn, and their reaction is to withdraw and just hide and hope everything goes away. And then the full extremes to anger and rage and whatever else, there's a whole range of responses to this. And often this, I don't want to be a problem, and you're a problem. And then you find out you've got dyslexia. Well, then, oh, dyslexia. Oh, yeah, that's a problem. You know, oh, we've got to give you some accommodation. That's a problem. And you know, we don't want to be problems. We're actually designed to be the solution to problems. We solve problems. We aren't the problem. And it's just, isn't that fascinating? You know, being a problem child is really what you're describing, isn't it? And being given the problem children, you know, and it follows up into adulthood as well. I don't want to be a problem here, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I change it around now. I think I like being the problem.
Oh, really? Yeah.
I like going in and causing disruption
The disruptor. Yeah. Things.
But okay. You're dead right. And it's interesting because one of my friends, her daughter, has just been diagnosed with dyslexia. Those exact words are what she used. Mom, I don't want to be the problem. I don't want my friends to know I've got a problem, is what she said. I don't want my friends to know. It's because one of the things that the teacher has suggested, that she moves from the back of the class to the front of the class, so she can access, you know, the teacher quickly and read the board and all that kind of stuff. And she just doesn't want that at all. She doesn't want to be given that special attention. She just doesn't want people to know. And my friend contacted me to see if I could have a word with her. And it's so sad, because I don't think we've moved that far along. And it's not teachers' faults, because they're not taught to understand this really big complexity, which is very different for every individual child who's dyslexic.
So you go into schools. So how do you view education at the moment and its relationship to dyslexia?
We've got better. I think it's still, in a lot of schools, it's seen as, okay, so how do we treat that child differently, rather than how do we create a classroom that's inclusive? And they're two very, very different things. And the whole education system is not set up for people who think differently, whether you're dyspraxic, dyslexic, ADHD, with any kind of neurodiversity, autism. It's set up to help young people who have classic, and I say classic because, but IQ. And we know classic IQ doesn't really exist anymore. It's been poo-pooed, because EQ and SQ, emotional intelligence and social intelligence, are as important as our skills for maths and history and English and stuff like that. So it's still incredibly set up around the old-fashioned way, rather than teaching young people, and this is for every young person, the skills to be able to get out of situations, to problem solve, to communicate, to think through a challenge. They're all the skills that are needed now, but we're still teaching kids by rote.
This podcast is sponsored by dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com, which helps you organize yourself creatively with a productivity system for Apple devices. Well, so we kind of covered the classic four questions that we always ask, you know, what was your what was life like before? What was your wake-up call? I find it fascinating that often the wake-up call in the UK is much later than in America.
Right, I didn't know that. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how many people that I speak to that their kids discover their dyslexia when they're in their teens in the UK compared to when they're in America, when they're often 7, 8 years old. And I suspect actually it's probably because we teach reading more phonically.
Right, yeah.
In the primary school now. So it's more dyslexic friendly in the phonics. And so a lot of the mild to moderate dyslexics click and get the reading eventually because they're being taught phonically to some degree. It's not at the standard of Wilson or Barton and so on, the Orton-Gillingham system, but it is more phonic. But they still got the associated organizational challenges, comprehension challenges, etc., that only start getting picked up in the teen years when it becomes much more significant. So we got the big picture. How do you learn now? I mean, what's your kind of, oh, by the way, because we're sponsored by Bullet Map Academy and it's all about mind mapping, I love asking people about their mind mapping experience during their life. Some people are kind of like, never heard of it. Other people are like raving fans. And some people with dyslexia are like, oh, I tried that, but it was so confusing. Where are you in all that?
Oh, I everything has to be visual for me and drawn out and put out. And I'll spin my camera around very quickly just to show you my wall.
Yeah.
I can't do it too much because there's some sensitive information on there, but this is how my brain works.
Yes. Everything visual. Yeah. Brilliant.
Yeah. So yeah, putting stuff out for me and in colours is really helpful. And interestingly, so when I do big presentations, and this is probably a hangover from my comedy days as well, so I've got a super good memory, you know, I can remember stuff really well, and I remember in pictures a lot. And so when I'm doing big presentations where I'm presenting for an hour and a half or 2 hours to a big audience, whether it be virtual or please, we'll get back to face-to-face real people soon, I just have a set of pictures. That's all I have. And that's my routine. That's my presentation for those 2 hours. And that's all I need. So when I do mind mapping, words and pictures for me are super helpful.
Do you do it by hand?
Yeah, I'll do mind mapping by hand.
Yes.
But my presentation, the pictures are from my presentation, and I'll just pick those pictures out and put them down. But yeah, mind mapping, it's got to be on a big wall by hand. I find it really difficult to doing it on computers.
Me too. I really find that sort of manual processing of it actually helps me think through the subject as well.
Well, there's been some research on that. So, because one of the things I always say to people in organisations as well, and this is really important as well for dyslexics, is we've started to, quite rightly so, have paperless organisations. But what that ignores is being able to access information in a different way. So if I'm note taking from you and I'm note taking by typing, then I am not processing that information as well as when I write. So even if we write, and I notice you've got a computer that you write on there, but
my
even
iPad Pro, I love it. Yeah.
And I've got one as well. And even if we write with an iPad Pro, that's way better because we have to double compute that information. So first of all, when you say it, and then if I'm writing my notes or my mind maps, I have to then context that information for me to understand it, for me to note take. So I'm doubly understanding you as the person as well. So it's really good for us.
Yes, fantastic. So if you were to go back in time and I was to give you like a blank card, okay, and you could choose what was on the front of the card and what was on the inside of the card, and we could send it back in time to Stephanie when she was a teenager or a child, what would it say?
Oh gosh, so the front of the card would have to be a picture, because that's what would capture me. If it was words, I'd be like, oh, I'm not opening that at all. I'd like to have money inside it. Is that allowed?
Yeah, send yourself some money. Yeah, you could send yourself some Google shares.
Ever
or
the entrepreneur.
Like
ever the entrepreneur. Yeah. So on the front of it, I think there'd be a picture of sunshine. Sunshine, I just love the sunshine, and something to entice me opening it. And I think I was quite, you wouldn't think about it now, but I was quite a sad teenager, which I didn't show a lot, but I cry a lot in my room by myself. And so I'd probably put something in there of a strategy. One of the things I talk to other people about now is mantras. So I'd put probably a mantra in there, which is something like, dyslexia is your superpower, use it. But I wouldn't have known I was dyslexic then, but you know.
Find... Well, we did say you're dyslexic,
yeah,
take it seriously, dyslexia is your superpower.
Exactly, so that's what it should be on the front. A great way to tell young people, you're dyslexic, and then open it up as this is your superpower, find out how to use it well. And God, wouldn't that be a great way to present dyslexia to young people, that this is a superpower, you know, this is amazing, and it'll give you more than it takes away. That's the important message.
Well, okay, will it? You know, like, and I'm being devil's advocate here, because there are some people who are in jail who are dyslexic, and they've not found the skills to unlock their superpower. It's one thing having potential, but it's another thing realizing that potential. Yeah. And there are some people who have the superpower, but they've not found a way to access it. And it's not automatic. I mean, I think when I think back to, for example, you know, Rob, was it Rob? The guy who sat one-to-one
Roger,
with you?
Roger,
you know, and then other individuals who speak with you and just wake up things and equip you and so on. And you start, and then you start being able to really engage your abilities. Not everyone gets that.
No, and you're right. And then it does become something, and that's why I think I'd have it, if we can tell young people, look, you know, this will give you more than it takes away, and help them with that early on.
Yes.
So what are the things it gives you? I think that's the switch we need to get to, isn't it? That
yes,
because I think being told you're dyslexic, you almost feel that things are taken away from you.
Yes.
Or that you're, it's a negative thing.
Yes.
Whereas we need to switch it that, you know, with everything, with all kinds of neurodiversity, it's just, it's a difference. It's, I can understand why people call it a disability, because it feels disabling when you're not aware of how to turn it round.
Yes.
And that's, like you said, sad, demotivating. Like I said, I was a teenager who didn't know that that's what it was and would cry. So it's incredibly impactful on your mental health and those things.
Well, there's a lot of people listening to this are parents, often with teenagers, you know, they've kind of gone past that stage of, oh, dyslexia is just about reading. And they start realizing, oh my God, goodness, it affects a lot more negatively and positively, and I want to find out about both. Are you a parent yourself?
No.
So would you have any advice to parents, you know, like if you could go back in time or speak to some of the parents that are there, what would you say to them as advice, if you feel comfortable sharing?
Yeah, I'm fine with it. So, you know, listen to their side of the story. That's the biggest, really try and walk in their shoes, see what it's like. And it can be ever so frustrating, because as a parent, you're seeing the behavior, you're experiencing the behavior.
Yeah.
You're not experiencing the feeling, you're not experiencing the challenge that young person feels so deeply. So try and walk in their shoes. really hear what they're saying, not just listen, but hear what it feels like. And also try and find the things that motivate, that inspire them, and really focus on those things that important, and praise the effort, you know, all that kind of good stuff that we know. And the biggest thing that you can do is spend time, you know, time is, it'll make the biggest difference in that child's life. Even when the child says point blankly they don't want to spend time with you, they do.
Thanks for that. You know, I remember, you know, like, I wonder, when you were crying at night, did your parents know you were crying at night?
No, I don't think so. I had a cat. I'm still a cat person today. So I had a cat called Top Cat, TC.
Oh, and you had a TC. I love, yeah, Top Cat. That's, yeah, a great name for a cat.
And TC was my best mate. And he would sit and listen to everything. And so I would tell him everything of why I was upset, what, how I felt, what it, you know, what it was. I wouldn't tell anybody else. And I think one of the biggest things, you know, the move for me to the Isle of Man, there was lots of things going on. So, you know, my dad stayed in Liverpool, my mum took us to the Isle of Man. So all that buried with, then you don't feel like you're fitting in for lots of reasons. So for whatever reason, maybe because I'd been in the school in Liverpool all my life, and they just accepted that that's Stephanie and that's how she is, and they hadn't identified it yet. But when I went to the Isle of Man, the biggest shift, I remember thinking, we had a spelling test every Friday by a teacher who was brilliant, by the way, called Mr. Clark, who I really loved and taught in a really special way. But he was very, very strict on spelling, and it was never something that anyone had pulled me up on before that time. So when I went into his class, when I moved to the Isle of Man and we'd have these spelling tests, I just couldn't understand why everybody else could spell and not me. I thought I was really behind, and maybe my school in Liverpool hadn't taught. If I think about it now, maybe they just accepted, oh, that's just Steph, she'll catch up. But when you then see with a fresh pair of eyes where I'm at and where my peers are at, maybe that teacher was just like, oh, that's not right. And he didn't know. I mean, he was a lovely teacher, so I don't want to say it was his fault, but, you know, I remember thinking, why am I thick now I've gone to the Isle of Man? And I wasn't when I was in my school in Liverpool. Why am I feeling, really being aware of that difference now?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the exercises that we get parents to do with their kids is a bullet map brainstorm, we call it. So it's a mind map, but basically you write down all your thoughts randomly as a bullet list. You underline some key ideas and then move them over into the map to have an organized map, because most dyslexics, when they go straight into a map, it's a chaotic map that doesn't actually help them that much, because all they just see is the chaos in their mind kind of vomited into this splatter pattern. So the bullet map brainstorm helps them do that. And one of the fascinating things is some kids ask their parents to do one of these every night. And I'm surprised at this, because we tend to get them to do it once a week just to empty their brain of what's going on. And what happens is they get all the busyness out their brain onto a piece of paper. And then one of the key ideas that comes up becomes a talking point. And they sit in their bed and they talk to their mum or dad about that thing. And it's an opportunity for them to actually share what's on their heart, because actually sometimes they don't even know what is throwing around in their head, because there's so much of it they can't talk about it. But when they see it written down and drawn out, they're like, yeah, that's right, and they can chat about it. And it surprises me how sometimes, you know, I did this exercise once I do this with Dyslexia Scotland sometimes, where we just get a bunch of people into a room, into a Zoom room or whatever, and I map a volunteer's busy brain out. And we had this six-year-old put his hand up and say, I'll do it. I'm stressed out about a reading assignment tomorrow. I asked for someone who's stressed, and we go through it, and there's all sorts of difficulties with the reading assignment and so on. And we process it. And then the very last question we ask is, what's the next best thing you can do that will take you less than 25 minutes? And everyone was looking at this going, oh my goodness, you know, this kid's really having a tough time in school. Should we go and speak to the teacher? Should we do this? Should we do that? And he ended up saying, I think the next best thing to do is to sit with mum and do our busy brain talk. And mum says, I can sit down when I have a busy brain. I come and sit with her and I just empty my busy brain and we talk about one of the things in my busy brain and then I go to sleep. And that was his solution.
And do you know what? I think for dyslexic, that's a real challenge. I have such a busy brain. And that's why lots of dyslexics are entrepreneurs, you know, because it's almost an excitement in the brain, especially when you're, especially when you've got something that you're mulling over, or that if you're excited about something, it's like ping, 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 ping after the other.
Yeah.
And it's exhausting because trying to get those things in order
is
really difficult.
Yes.
And talking, you know, my husband's not a talker and I am. So he just sits there, which is good. But yeah, Top Cat was I was emptying my brain on Top Cat.
Yeah,
that's what I was doing. You know,
your therapy pet.
Oh yeah, every time, bless him. I don't think he knew.
My daughter, who's dyslexic, she has Moses, our cat, and she just loves cuddling him and talking to him as well.
Yeah.
21. Moses is, what is he? He's 13, 14, he's getting on. We're all just wondering when he's going to, how long he'll stay with us. So your toolbox, what's in your dyslexia toolbox? And I think I'm going to ask you, you mentioned your husband, okay? Yeah. It's a terrible thing to call a person a tool. And so we shouldn't call,
we should change that.
What support arrangements do you have around in your life with dyslexia? And you mentioned some things about your husband before this interview.
Yeah, so I married my husband not because of this, but he's a writer, and he's actually in our vows to each other. One of his vows was, "I promise to always correct your spelling and grammar."
Oh, fantastic!
And that was one of his vows because when we first met, obviously you don't say, "Oh, I'm dyslexic," but we'd type or text or email each other because he lived quite far away. I was in the north and he was in the south, and he'd often pick up some quite interesting mistakes. But one of the things he taught me, which sounds really simple, and it's often the most simple things, because he's a journalist, and he said, whenever you write something, just read it back out loud, and if it makes sense out loud, it will make sense. And Why has no one ever told me that or told children? It's so simple. So I learned that when I was 32, you know, and it's something that I use constantly now. Why did no one ever tell me to read back stuff out loud? It's really simple. So that's one of my tools, my toolbox. The other thing is just telling people I'm dyslexic. I tell people constantly that I am, and I'm proud of it as well. And the other thing is, I also know when I need to read stuff, I know when my brain works best. So start of the day, I'm an early bird, one of these annoying morning happy people. I'm not a grumpy morning person, I'm a happy morning person. But my brain works best at that time when no one's about. So I need, when I'm reading papers or that's when I do that reading as well.
Okay.
And if I have some information and I don't really understand it, as well is I'll just go to Google and I'll go to Google Images.
Yes.
And I'll put the information in and I'll put it in images. And it usually pings up a graph or something like that. And I guess it. So yes. That's a really good top tip.
That's a great tip. That is just an amazing tip. I mean, I do, when I'm mapping things out, okay, and I'm trying to think through things, I sometimes write down something and I go, what image would go with that? What make, and I start doing the Google thing.
Yeah.
And gosh, it's so incredible when you see Google sharing lots of things and obscure images that, why is that related? And then it starts giving you this sort of bigger picture and you lock in.
Yeah,
brilliant.
Yeah. And often Google will give you a graph or an image or a model for something. Yeah, I love a model. Well, if you can explain something in a model, you don't need to give me a whole paper on it. I'm fine with that, you know.
An infographic.
Yeah.
With a model inside it, even better.
Yeah.
What you mean by a model, do you mean like a flow chart type structure process? You can see the whole process in one go?
Absolutely. So if I can see it in one go, for me, that's the big thing. You know, I need to see it in one go. They're my top tips, really.
Fantastic. Look, Steph, I want to talk to you about dyslexia in the workplace. Like you, we've been talking about school and so on, but you also go into the workplace and do a lot of work in the workplace. So tell us something a bit about how you see dyslexia in the workplace.
So the way we work in workplaces and Laughology is the clue. So we deliver learning, and that could be anything like we talked about before, from manager programs to resilience. And my passion is that we learn when we enjoy something, and that's not just me saying it. We know neuroscience tells us that when there's dopamine, oxytocin, serotonin and endorphins, we learn through that positive memory. Now, the reason why I talk about that is because quite often learning when you're dyslexic becomes a negative experience.
Yeah.
So one of the reasons why I set up Laughology is because I love learning now. I absorb everything and anything I can get my hands on to read and learn about. I love it. And it's really important for our well-being, learning.
Yes.
Because it helps us to have purpose. It helps us to ground us. It also helps us understand certain things in the world. So really important for our happiness and well-being. So when you go into workplaces and there are things in place that are processes or systems that impact on dyslexia or any kind of neurodiversity, it's still hugely problematic. And I always talk about my dyslexia whenever I start a webinar of anything. And the way I do it is, I'll put up on a screen, whether it's face to face or in a screen in a session, and I'll say to people, okay, you have to guess which one I am. And I put up two scenarios. So I'll say, was I head girl or was I naughty girl? And people will say head girl every time. So I think this is really fooling people. It didn't when I was younger, but I think it is now. No one really says naughty girl. And so then I talk about my story. And the reason why I talk about that is because there's always, what you see isn't what you assume. And so people coming into the workplace, no matter whether they're new or they've been there for a long time, we make assumptions about people. And those assumptions, they're not necessarily bad or negative, but we're assuming that that person does the job in this way, or we're assuming that this process will be okay for that person, and we're assuming that this person knows this because that's our assumption. So the whole point that we need to get to is, how do we work best by really understanding individuals, what motivates them, what makes them happy, how to get the very best out of them. And in doing that, we will probably get some real engagement. You know, it's a worky term, but people will love what they do because you have invested some time in them. Now, this is a manager thing. It's a leadership thing. So if we get managers who just really understand the human being, the person, it makes a whole lot of difference. And when I first started delivering Laughology in organizations, whatever that meant, whether it is a workshop, a comedy workshop, a resilience workshop, a manager's session, the reason why I did it is because I was invited into a bank to help leaders use humor as a way to engage their audiences differently. And I was 23 and I was like, I don't even know what that means, but I'll do it. And I'll think later. And they were using all these really big words and, you know, it's talking in this certain way and speaking to each other. And I was like, what is going on in this world? Where's the humans? What's happened? And we are seeing a breakdown in that now, where workplaces are human focused, not data focused and not number focused. And it just was really common sense to me that you be nice to people and you really understand what they need, they will give you more than what you need. You know, it's about individual happiness. And it all stems from, I wasn't happy at school. I wasn't a happy young person. So I didn't achieve my best. But if you want people to achieve their best, then really understand them and help them be the best that they can be.
Help them be happy.
Help them be happy.
If they're happy at work, then they'll be really good at working.
Yeah, it's simple, isn't it?
Yeah.
Who's the thought of that concept? Don't tell anyone. It's so simple. Shh. If people find me out, I'm done for.
And that's your job, to help them be happy at work.
Yeah, that's my title. I'm head of happiness, because I couldn't think of any other title that I'd rather have.
That is fantastic.
Yeah, and dyslexia has given me that, you know, to really understand other people. And I truly want to help people be happy in what they do.
You know, there are other people called head of happiness, you know, in organizations. Is it like, I think my wife was telling me that, yeah, there was an organization, she's in HR and so on, and they said, yeah, I'm head of happiness.
They have chief happiness officers.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I was.
What have you started, Stephanie?
I was doing this 16 years ago.
Yeah,
Before happiness was allowed. But it's great. And there has been a fundamental shift. And especially in the current climate of what's going on, people have really realized, look, if people aren't feeling great, they're not working. And, you know, that's what dyslexia gave me, an understanding of, if I'm not feeling great, if I am not getting stuff, I'm just not going to be the best person that I can be. And haven't we all got a right to be happy? And it's not about being happy all the time. I don't believe in that either, because it's okay to have all the other emotions. It's how we get through. But yeah.
What give us some happiness tips, would you, finally, before we go? I know that's a big subject, but what are your standards, sort of top three happiness tips for our listeners?
Okay, so my first one is what I call realistic happiness. So it's this idea that chasing happiness will make you unhappy, which sounds really bizarre when someone's so passionate about happiness, but it's okay not to be happy, but it's about how we get through it. So that's number one. Number two is friends, positive relationships. You know, we have to work at relationships, but surround yourself with people who are good for you in different ways. And I call these your happiness heroes. So your happiness heroes are a list of people, and it might be someone who makes you laugh. Then it might be someone who can tell you and be really honest with you and give you really good feedback. It might be somebody who you can just be calm with and who calms you. So who are the people in your life who give you different things, your happiness heroes? The third one is always learn. Always have a curiosity. So be curious to find stuff out. Don't just close stuff down. Ask yourself the question, what more could I know about this situation? The other one is do something for other people. So if you're feeling sad, go out your way to do something for somebody else. So the other day, I was just having one of those days that we've all had in lockdown where I was thinking, oh, I miss my family, I haven't seen them. It's hard work. I feed off an audience and this audience is behind a screen now. And so I went to the local coffee shop and a woman just came up beside me. So I just said, oh, hello, how are you? She'd just come out of having a hip operation. It was her first day out and she'd come out with a friend. So I just said to the lady behind the counter, can I buy their coffees as well? That's all I did. And I paid for them. And so when she came to collect her coffees, they said, oh, they paid. And I didn't need the thanks. It was just that thing. I've done something for somebody else that has made their day. And it gives you a boost.
Yes.
And then the other one, which is my favorite, I always talk about know your laughter triggers. So your laughter triggers are the memories, the things that we have that we've just got in our brain that make us laugh. And we just need to revisit them sometimes.
Yeah.
And it gives us a happiness boost.
Yeah.
Because thinking about them, actually the brain doesn't know the difference between reality and memory. So thinking about them, the brain is as if you're back there really. And it gives you the serotonin, the endorphins.
Yes.
And you can lose yourself in that moment again and you can feel that surge. So I call
that is so good.
Your laughter triggers.
That is so good. I mean, it's one of these things when it's so obvious when you say it, but it's not obvious before you say it. And I'm just thinking, what are mine? I don't have a memory bank of these laughter triggers. But the first thing that comes to my mind is seeing my 1-year-old, 2-year-old daughter trying to walk up the stairs, but then she falls asleep on halfway up the stairs. She's walking up the stairs and falls asleep with her head down on the thing, sucking her thumbs. And she's like in mid step, up the step, resting on the steps, falling completely asleep. And we're just standing there going, that's so adorable.
And it's really interesting. So when I was saying about laughter triggers, if you look back at the video, when I was saying about them, I could see that you went off to thinking. And then I saw the moment that you thought that because your face lit up completely.
Yes.
And so from a scientific point of view, what's happening is you're thinking it. So your body's reacting to it. You're smiling, which is giving you the facial feedback theory to tell your brain you are happy because that's what's going on with your face.
Yes.
And so you're getting a double whammy of happiness.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, Steph, we didn't talk about your book.
Oh!
Tell us about your book quickly before we finish off. What's the book about?
It's called Laughology, The Science of Laughter to Improve Your Life. There you go.
Fantastic. And it's got a picture of Einstein on the front, a dyslexic.
Dyslexic.
With a red nose on it. That's a really good idea.
And one of the things I said as well, so if you do get this book, it's the feel of it, because I'm a very touchy-feely person. I don't know if that's a dyslexic thing. I smell everything as well. So my other senses are really heightened. So it's got a cover on it, which has got a very soft feel to it. And that's one thing that I asked for. But what it is, and I was super proud of writing this book. And it was also, so Philip Schofield, who is a big presenter star over here, who's on the biggest breakfast program in the UK. Oh, what's she called? Susan Sandett? She was in a film, a famous actress. I can't remember her name. Susan something. She was in the film where they drive off the cliff together, the two women.
Oh, is that Thelma and Louise?
Thelma and Louise. She is was it? In Thelma and Louise.
Right.
So she came on. She heard it was Phil's birthday. He's the big presenter for people who don't know. And she gave Phil my book.
Wow, that's fantastic.
And she said, I've read this and it's brilliant. And so I've brought it in for your birthday because I know you like to laugh. So Philip Schofield then tweeted it, put it on Facebook, and all those things. So that's my super proud moment from someone who can't write or thought difference, who thought they couldn't write.
Yes.
And it's a workbook, so it's all about top tips to use laughter as a coping mechanism for happiness.
Well, I think a lot of people with dyslexia use laughter intentionally, unconsciously, but intentionally, as a distraction technique, as a negotiation technique, in the way that you're describing, as a way to learn, as a way to remember, all sorts of different ways. And by the way, remember, all of the things that Steph has been referring to will be in the show notes. Just swipe up on your podcast app, you'll see some words and there'll be the hyperlinks to her website, the book, you know, different resources that she's mentioned and so on. So make sure you click through to those resources. Just fantastic. Thank you so much, Steph, for sharing.
It's been a pleasure. I've loved every minute of it. It's taken me down memory lane. So thank you.
Thank you for sharing your dyslexia story. See you later. This podcast is sponsored by dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com. It's my day job when I'm not hosting this podcast. Tell me, do you know what you want to achieve in the workplace, but you're struggling with how to achieve it? Maybe you suspect some traits of dyslexia are getting in the way. Well, that's where Dyslexia Productivity Coaching comes in, because we give you a simple productivity system for your Apple devices that harnesses the creativity that comes with your dyslexia. It includes proven methods like note-taking, reminders, speech-to-text, mind mapping, and more, all tailored to your needs. It'll free up your time and help you achieve outstanding results. Book a complimentary call to discuss it with me, and if you do it soon, I may also be available to coach you personally via Zoom. So don't be shy, go to dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com or swipe up and book it now.